901 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to the All Souls Forum. On today's show, the topic is surveillance culture, NSA spying, and the FISA court. The expert speakers are Gary Brunk, the executive director of the Kansas ACLU, and KU sociology professor, Dr. Bill Staples. So let's start with the show.
Consider this. When Ike warned us, the defense budget at that time, the Pentagon budget, was about $56 billion. That's what we call the military budget. If you put that in today's numbers, that $56 billion would be about $450 billion today. If the defense budget just increased with inflation. However, we consider the military budget, even though officially the United States government says that the military budget is $750 billion, it's really $1 trillion, which is $1,000 billion, and I base that on the work of the late Professor Chalmers Johnson. Because when we take into account Veterans Affairs, we take into account Veterans Retirement, we take into account that nukes are in the Energy Department, and they play a lot of sleight of hand with what they consider the military budget, then we know that it's at least $1 trillion. But that $1 trillion does not include the interest on the debt that we've incurred in wars. It doesn't include all of the surveillance organizations, FBI, CIA, DIA, the DEA. And if we take all of that into account, we're probably spending about $1.5 trillion today on the military-industrial complex, because the surveillance state that has been spawned and grown up around the defense budget is part of the military-industrial complex. So, you know, all of the organizations sponsoring this event are interested in connecting the dots. What is the relationship between the needs of our children, of our elderly, of the poor, of making a better society, and the surveillance state? The vast spying apparatus now unleashed on the public sucks up resources, and rather than focus on suspected terrorists, determined to be suspected terrorists by good intelligence, the government's spying activities are dragging all citizens into the spy network and unnecessarily encroaching on personal space as guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. Today, the surveillance portion of the military-industrial complex is costing us. Now, I'm taking the surveillance portion. We're going to get into that. That's where we're going with this. It's about $150 billion just for what we're spending on spying, our spying apparatus. That is a relationship between our government and corporations that are doing business in the spy business, and we're talking most of the major military industrial contractors. Mark Marietta, Hewlett-Packard, and so forth. But here, and this is what you're going to hear today, is when life becomes untenable for large groups of people, And as the African-American community learned in past decades, and they started a political movement, a mass movement, to rectify injustice, that spying apparatus can be turned on them. It will be turned on us. And that is the issue that we also have to think about. So that's why we're here today. And with that, let me introduce our first speaker today, and when our featured speaker is done, we will then have the panel discussion. So today, I would like to introduce at this time Gary Brunk, who is the executive director of the ACLU of Kansas. Recently, he was the executive director of ACLU of Kansas and Missouri, but they've kind of split into two entities now. Gary's an old friend of mine. I've heard Gary speak at other forums, so I think you're in for a real interesting time and a good talk. So with that, Gary, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. I had a really hard time focusing on what I wanted what I wanted to talk about tonight, because, and I'm just going to be talking about NSA surveillance, and other people will talk a little bit about the other kinds of surveillance that David was referring to, but just focused on foreign intelligence surveillance. There is so much to be said. It's so complicated. It's so easy to get lost in the weeds. I thought I would try to help all of us a little bit. There's a sheet that I hope you have that's called Domestic Spying, brief explanation of some key actors in legislation. It's hard to talk about what I'm going to talk about without saying things like FISA or FISC. And so this is just a little brief cheat sheet of two organizations that are relevant for our discussion, the National Security Agency, and also the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA Court. And then three pieces of legislation and regulation that have everything to do with the conversation today. The FISA Act of 1978, the FISA Amendment Act of 2008, and then Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And I'll be referring to those as I'm talking this evening. In July of 2010, the Washington Post published a series of articles that grew out of a two-year investigation that they did. They titled the series Top Secret America, and this is how the first article begins, and this is kind of an extended quote. So this is the article. The top secret world the government created in response to the terrorist act of September 11, 2001 has become so large, so unwieldy, and so secretive that no one knows how much money it costs, how many people it employs, how many programs exist within it, or exactly how many agencies do the same work. These are some of the findings of a two-year investigation by the Washington Post that discovered what amounts to an alternative geography of the United States, a top-secret America hidden from public view and lacking in thorough oversight. After 9 years of unprecedented spending and growth, the result is that the system put in place to keep the United States safe is so massive that its effectiveness is impossible to determine. The article goes on. The investigation's other findings include some 1,271 government organizations and 1,931 private companies worked on programs related to counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence in about 10,000 locations across the United States. An estimated 854,000 people, nearly 1.5 times as many people as live in Washington, D.C., hold top secret security clearances. Of course, Edward Snowden was one of them. And then the final point from the article, analysts who make sense of documents and conversations obtained by foreign and domestic spying agencies share their judgment by publishing 50,000 intelligence reports each year, a volume so large that many are routinely ignored. End of quote. In 2012, Wired magazine published an article by James Bamford, who's written a lot extensively on surveillance issues. And the article was about the construction of the National Security Agency's biggest spy center, located in Bluffdale, Utah. According to Bamford, the $2 billion center would encompass 1 million square feet of space and include 4 25,000 square foot halls to house servers, 900,000 square feet for technical support and administration, an electric power substation and fuel tanks and backup generators. Various recent reports indicate that while the NSA is mum about this, the center's probably up and running by now. And this reminds me of NSA, National Security Agency, some people call it the No Secrets Agency. And that means we can't have secrets, because they certainly can, and they do, obviously. And just this past Sunday, in a front-page article in the New York Times titled NSA Examines Social Networks of U.S. Citizens, the Times, again based on documents released by Snowden, described how the NSA, and I quote, has been exploiting its huge collection of data to create sophisticated graphs of some Americans' social connections that it can identify their associates, their locations at certain times, their traveling companions, and other personal information, end of quote. In the last few months, we've learned enough to know that if we had any illusions about the privacy of our telephone conversations, our internet trolling, our emails, or our credit card purchases, we were completely, utterly, absolutely, and yes, probably foolishly wrong. In fact, The National Security Agency has officially stopped sugarcoating the fact that it was a spy on all Americans a couple of weeks ago. In a hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Mark Udall asked NSA Director Keith Alexander, General Keith Alexander, whether his spy agency should be collecting all Americans' phone records. And Alexander, in an amazingly forthcoming response, admitted that he, and this is a quote, he believes it is in the nation's best interest to put all the phone records into a lockbox that we can search when the nation needs it. End of quote. And he also went on to explain that there is no upper limit, in his words, to the number of Americans' phone records that the NSA can collect. Now, how the NSA collects all this information is an evolving story, and we know from Glenn Greenwald, who, writing for The Guardian, was the first to begin exposing the documents released by Snowden. We know from what he's written that there's more to come. I mean, those were thousands of documents, and we only really know at this point probably about a relatively small proportion of them. So who knows what is going to be revealed. But so it's a complicated story, and again, it's easy to get into the weeds. But I just want to tell you about two NSA programs that seem to be important for what we're talking about. Through a program called PRISM, the NSA receives data directly from companies like Google and Facebook, including foreign targets, emails, texts, video chats, photographs, and more. A second program, Upstream, collects the communications they pass through underseas fiber optic cables. So something like 80% of the world's communication are carried by those cables. So as the NSA is tapping into that in the process, the communications of many Americans are also swept into the NSA's vast coverage, vast storage capacity. So these are two critical programs that we know help NSA collect data, but we also that there are other ones. Documents released by Snowden also mentioned a program called Shell Trumpet, and two programs that may have been activated just this September called Moonlight Path and Spinneret. I love that, Moonlight Path and Spinneret. Where do they get these names? But what to do with all this data? This is another program revealed by Edward Snowden that fits into this puzzle, and that's X-KeyScore, basically a powerful search engine. X-KeyScore allows NSA analysts to target anyone for whom they have identifying information, such as an email address, a name, a telephone number, an IP address, and to obtain information without a warrant. And I don't know if it was his first or second interview, Snowden said that sitting at his desk at work, he could wiretap anyone, including the president, if he had an email address. And he was roundly criticized for saying that. He was called a liar by congressional leaders. Government officials vigorously asserted that was just not possible, that no NSA analyst could do that. But in fact, what we know about X-KeyScore is that NSA analysts seem to be able to precisely do whatever Snowden said that they did. The secret documents released this summer confirm what critics have long suspected, that the NSA is engaged in unconstitutional surveillance of Americans' communication, including their telephone calls and their emails. And the documents show that the NSA is conducting sweeping surveillance of America's international communication, that is, acquiring many purely domestic communications as well, and that the rules that supposedly protect Americans' privacy are weak and riddled with exceptions. The FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Amendment Act, so this is not FISA, this is the FISA Amendment Act, signed into law by President Bush in 2008, expanded the government's authority to monitor Americans' electronic communications. Critics of the law feared that the NSA would use the law to conduct broad surveillance of Americans' international communications and in the process capture an unknown quantity of purely domestic communications. Now, government officials then contended that the law authorized surveillance of foreign nationals outside the United States, not of Americans, and that it included very robust safeguards to protect Americans' privacy. Last year, in fact, in a successful effort to derail a constitutional challenge to the law, the Obama administration made exactly the same claims before the U.S. Supreme Court. Now the Guardian has published two previously secret documents that show how the FISA Amendment Act is being implemented. One document sets out the government's targeting procedures, that is, the procedures it uses to determine whether it has the authority to acquire the communications in the first place. And the other document sets out the government's minimization procedures, the procedures that govern the retention, analysis, and dissemination of the communication that acquires. Both documents, we'll just call them the procedures, have apparently been endorsed by the FISA court, which oversees government surveillance in some national security cases. The procedures are complicated. I have 10 pages that describe the procedures. I'm going to skip them, except I'm going to tell you about the first two. One is the procedure permits the NSA to monitor Americans' international communications in the course of surveillance targeted at foreigners abroad. Many government officials, including President Obama, have given us assurance time and again that the NSA is not listening to Americans' phone calls or monitoring our email. Those statements are simply not true. While the FISA Amendment Act authorizes the government to target foreigners abroad, not Americans, it permits the government to collect Americans' communication with those foreign targets. Indeed, in advocating for the act, government officials made clear that those communications were the ones that were of most interest to them. The procedures contemplate that not only the NSA will acquire Americans' international communications, but that it will retain them and possibly disseminate them to other government agencies and foreign governments. And a few weeks ago, there was an article, I think, in the Times again, talking about how it's very probable that the NSA has been sharing information with Israeli intelligence, for example. Despite government's claims to the contrary, it's clear that the NSA is building a growing database of Americans' international telephone calls and emails. The second point about the procedures that I wanted to make was that they allow the surveillance of Americans by failing to ensure that the NSA's surveillance targets are, in fact, foreigners outside the United States. The act is predicated on the theory that foreigners abroad have no rights to privacy, or at any rate, no rights that we as the United States are willing to recognize. Parenthetically, this is not going over very well with Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, who has refused to come and visit with the president, or with other world leaders, some of them who we call allies. Because foreigners, according to the procedures, have no right to privacy, the U.S. government sees no bar to the collection of their communications, including their communications with Americans. But even if one accepts the government's premise, the procedures fail to ensure that the NSA surveillance targets are, in fact, foreigners outside the United States. This is because the procedures permit the NSA to presume that the prospective surveillance targets are foreigners outside the United States, absent specific information to the contrary, and to presume, therefore, that they're fair game for warrantless surveillance. So my wife right now is spending 5 weeks in the UK. We've been Skyping. Well, because she's in the UK and she's communicating with me, I could be a target of surveillance, as well as many other Americans could. I'm going to skip the other six procedures, and I'll just give you the summary. In summary, the implementation procedures for the FISA Amendment Act permit the NSA to monitor Americans' international communications in the course of surveillance targeted at foreigners abroad. Allow the surveillance of Americans by failing to ensure that the NSA surveillance targets are, in fact, foreigners outside the United States. Permit the government to conduct surveillance that has no real connection to the government's foreign intelligence interests. Permit the NSA to collect international communications, including Americans' international communications, in bulk. Allow the NSA to retain even purely domestic communications. Allow the government to collect and retain communications protected by attorney-client privilege. Contemplate that the NSA will maintain knowledge databases, that's their term, containing sensitive information about Americans, and allow the NSA to retain encrypted communications indefinitely. And as we know from other recent revelations, the NSA has been super busy cracking encryption codes. Encryption codes that business system that we use, when I communicate with Skype, that information is supposed to get encrypted. I presume that there's some privacy in that communication because it's supposed to be encrypted. Businesses depend on encrypted communication. Banks do, and others do too. And the NSA has been busy cracking those codes. And so if we thought that encrypted communication allowed for privacy, it often doesn't. Now, I'm sure there's highly sophisticated encryption methods that are still worked at. I know for a fact that Snowden, for example, in communicating with the Guardian, uses encryption. Much of the encrypted communication the NSA can tap into now. So, should we care that the government has all this information if we're not doing anything illegal? As the nation's founders knew too well, unchecked power is inevitably abused. They understood this danger in a very personal way because they lived under the British Crown, and the British Crown used general warrants to harass and spy on the colonists by giving law enforcement officers broad authority to search and seize unspecified places or persons. Because of the founders' experience of repression and harassment, we have the Bill of Rights, and particularly the First and the Fourth Amendments. And federal surveillance also has implications for us as individuals. We may act differently if we think that we're being watched constantly. By reading our emails, listening to our phone calls, accessing our library records and our financial transactions, looking at our internet searches, and tracking our trips to church, therapists, and to meet secret lovers, the government monitors not only our activities, but also the expressions of what makes each of us a unique being. In doing so, there's a real danger of encouraging conformity and stifling creativity. But unfettered surveillance also has societal implications because it chills political activity and dissent. It can discourage individuals from associating with controversial groups, donating to causes that the government and power dislikes, and expressing their views on controversial issues. And in fact, surveillance can act as a kind of diffuse but effective censorship, impoverishing the discourse on issues that should be freely and vigorously debated. Somebody compared this to, just imagine if you knew that there was an FBI agent tracking you 24 hours a day. You know, how would that impinge on the activities that you were engaged in? What we've learned about the reach of the surveillance state raises troubling questions about the balance of power, the rule of law, the survival rights many of us cherish, the health of our democracy. Let me just tell you very briefly what the ACLU, how the ACLU has responded is. You might expect we've been litigating. On June 10, 5 days after the first Guardian article, we filed a motion in the FISA court seeking access to judicial opinions that the FISA court had issued that interpreted the scope, meaning, or constitutionality of Section 2 and 5 of the Patriot Act, the statute that purportedly is authorizing the government's call tracking program. We actually persuaded a group of 60 members of Congress, including both Democrats and Republicans, to file a friend of the court brief in that case. On June 11, we filed a constitutional challenge to the mass call tracking program. Our case is titled ACLU Clapper, and we filed an opening brief in support of a motion for a preliminary injunction on August 26. So now this is a case that actually has some prior history. And that the Supreme Court decided against us, I think, at the beginning of the year. The ACLU and other organizations have made a petition to the court saying that they should have standing in trying to understand the law and its implications because they presumed that they were maybe being surveyed themselves. And what the Supreme Court said is, you don't know that they're actually watching you. Since you don't know that they're watching you, you don't have standing. And since you don't have standing, we're not going to go anywhere with this case. So now, when the revelations came out about the Verizon phone records, it so happens that the ACLU is a customer of Verizon. The ACLU now should have standing. And so we'll see where this court case goes now. On July 8th, we filed a friend of the court brief in support of a motion filed by Google and Microsoft in the FISA court. In the motion, the company sought permission to disclose the number of FISA court orders that they had received. And this is a whole other area. The FBI has the authority they send these demand letters, and companies or individuals have to respond to them, but they can't tell anybody about it. And so in this case, Microsoft and Google, concerned about their reputation, are trying to get the FISA court to allow them to sort of give out more information. And more recently, we've negotiated a schedule under which the Department of Justice will review and disclose documents responsive to a Freedom of Information request that we filed for records related to the Section 2 and 5 of the Patriot Act. And the Department of Justice is supposed to release those on September 10th, coming up soon. In addition to litigation, we're working with Congress to stop Dragnet surveillance and make the NSA more accountable and transparent. Specifically, we're telling Congress three things. That first, it should amend relevant portions of FISA to prohibit suspicious dragnet monitoring or tracking of Americans' communication. Second, it should end the unnecessary corrosive secrecy that has obstructed congressional and public oversight. It should require the publication of Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court opinions insofar as they evaluate the meaning, the scope, or the constitutionality of foreign intelligence laws. And third, it should ensure that the government's surveillance activities are subject to meaningful judicial review. It should clarify by statute the circumstances in which individuals can challenge government surveillance in ordinary federal courts. Will Congress act? Well, on the one hand, it's a little hard to imagine that this dysfunctional Congress can get anything done these days. But the outcry over the Snowden revelations have been significant, and they're prompting some members to try to do something. Right now, there's something like a dozen or so pending bills to seek to curtail NSA spying, and just in the last couple of weeks, there's been hearings on some of those bills. We understand that as early as this week, major legislation could be introduced in both the House and the Senate, authored by Republicans and Democrats, to roll back some of the laws that the ACLU has long been worried about, specifically the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendment Act. The Washington staff of the ACLU expects that a bill that's titled the U.S. Freedom Act, and I won't tell you what that stands for, the U.S. Freedom Act stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by Fulfilling Rights and Ending Eavesdropping, Dragnet Collection, and Online Monitoring. So all those letters are at some point the USA Freedom Act. The USA Freedom Act, it seems like, will be based on many of the recommendations that the ACLU has made, and if that's the case, passage of the Freedom Act will be a top legislative priority for the ACLU. So let's assume that a good bill passes the Congress and is signed by the President. Can we be confident that that will be the end of unlawful surveillance? And I say that the answer from our history is kind of a loud no. In the mid-70s, an investigative committee chaired by Senator Frank Church discovered that the NSA, through a secret agreement with the telecommunications companies, was illegally monitoring America's communication. There's a precedent to that, by the way. In the 20s, there wasn't an NSA, but whatever the agency was at that point that preceded it had an agreement with the telegraph companies, so they could tap into telegraph communications. The work of the Church Committee led to the 1978 FISA, which created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and required the NSA to get approval from that court before listening to Americans. After 9/11, the Bush administration began extensive warrantless, therefore illegal, wiretapping while insisting publicly that warrants were always obtained before targeting Americans. When the New York Times exposed the warrantless wiretapping in 2005, Congress responded by amending FISA so that what should have remained illegal became legal. They basically said, okay, well, this is what you've been doing. We want you to continue doing this. We'll make it legal by the FISA Amendment Act. And at the same time, by the way, they gave officials of the telecommunication companies that cooperate with the NSA immunity from prosecution, so nobody could sue them. But honestly, unfortunately, it did not improve under Obama. When James Clapper, the head of national intelligence, was asked in the Senate hearing if the NSA collected any data on millions of Americans, his answer was, no, sir, not willingly. When several months later it was revealed that the NSA did collect telephone data of Americans, Clapper said that his earlier response was not a lie, that he had responded in the least untruthful manner. Which begs the question, what would have been the most untruthful one? We've also learned to not trust the word of NSA Director General Keith Alexander, who repeatedly has stated that the agency did not keep data on U.S. citizens. Thanks to Edward Snowden, we know better. Senator Frank Church understood the dangers of untrammeled government surveillance. He said, this is a quote, "If this government ever becomes a tyrant, if a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know. Such is the capability of this technology. The NSA's technological capacity, when Senator Church said that in the 70s, was a pale shadow of its current capacity. In recent decades, NSA resources have grown, statutory and constitutional limitations have been steadily eroded, and the technology of surveillance has become exponentially more powerful than in Church's days. We know from history that when governments have the capacity to survey American citizens, they often come up with justifications to do so, and if necessary, will lie to cover it up. For that reason, the struggle against unconstitutional surveillance will take more than the ACLU's litigation, more than our lobbying, will take more than passing bills that seem to fix the problem. It will take whistleblowers like Edward Snowden and the ongoing watchful involvement of citizens across the country. Our nation's journey to the unfolding of the rights envisioned in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights has never been an easy or straight journey. To the extent we enjoy today a measure of freedom of speech, the right to vote, and other rights we cherish, it's because generations before us fought for them, many times at great personal risk. Today, we're in a struggle to define the meaning of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights for the 21st century. The ACLU believes that preventing unlawful government surveillance is an essential aspect of that struggle, and we look to you to be our partners. Thanks.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, meet Tim Shared, author of 6 mystery novels about Lenny Moss, amateur detective and hospital union shop steward. Then, we're going to explore why is Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker arresting singers. Meet the Solidarity Singers, who, with the Raging Grannies, are re-energizing the fight back against the governor's union busting. The Heartland Labor Forum will be heard Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
You have been listening to the All Souls Forum on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City's community radio. The first part of the show was Gary Brunk of the Kansas ACLU talking about the U.S. surveillance culture. Now stay tuned for the second half with KU sociology professor Dr. Bill Staples.
Rock, roll, rock, roll. You'd take some music.
This week's Thursday night special is music from the days when 45 RPM records ruled the world. Heartbeats, drums beat, finger popping, and stomping feet. Join me, D. Christopher, your host, for Moldy Oldies this Thursday night at 7.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Contrary to the myth in our culture that we separated an individual, aggressive, competitive creatures, we're actually wired for empathy, wired for connection, wired for love, wired for compassion.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join us for Inner Resilience with Dr. Gabor Mate on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
Thanks, Gary. Let's see. You're head of the ACLU in Kansas, and you were communicating with somebody by Skype in England. I wonder if you were targeted. NSA, by the way, too, I've heard is the initial stand for no such agency. Well, we have an excellent panel. I do want to say, what Gary said, that since the Church Committee, things have come back in spades, and we're looking at a huge expenditure for surveillance, as I mentioned, $150 billion probably to put it somewhere in the ballpark. And that's what we're talking about today, is how do we connect the dots between the government spying, protecting us from terrorism, militarism, an increasingly militaristic state, local militarized police forces, on and on and on. And our panel today is designed to sort of help us connect these dots. I think everyone on this panel has done such admirable work in looking at this issue and being leaders in the community. What I would like to do now is ask each of our panel members, I'm going to introduce each one of them, and ask each one of them to take 5 minutes or so to explain what they do, how they, what they're about, what their major focus is, and then we will have a chance for audience questions to the panel members. So first, let me introduce my good friend, Professor Bill Staples, former chair of the Department of Sociology at Kansas University. Bill's expertise is in the area of not government surveillance, but as and Bill, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in private surveillance. In other words, say what Google's doing to you right now, and what that's all about. And Bill, what's the title of your book again?
Everyday Surveillance.
Everyday Bill's book is Everyday Surveillance. I think the new edition's about ready to come out, and Bill might talk about that. Of course, we've listened to Gary. He's just done an excellent job of sort of summarizing the constitutional legal issues, which that dot is connected for us because, you know, I've heard so many people calling radio shows and say, well, I'm not doing anything. Why would I care? Well, you know, we've got principles. You know, it's about the principle. It's not about you. It's about the principle here. And why is that important? Next, Gary, on Gary's right is my good friend and fellow activist, Reverend Esther Holzendorf, who's a leader in the African American community, and we'll really talk about COINTELPRO and what that was all about, because as Gary stated, you know, we have a history in this country of surveillance and persecution. To a great degree, even assassinations that we've never really been able to explain. So Esther will address COINTELPRO and what that's meant and what it could mean in the future, the same type of operation. And to Esther's right is Henry Stover. Henry's an attorney. Henry has represented many activists in the community and is himself an activist in opposing and dissenting against the military-industrial complex, particularly in the nuclear area. So Henry is representing that perspective. Before we get started with the panel, I do want to remind myself to that Jane would like to make an announcement at the end of the panel. So Jane will make an announcement then. So I would like to now turn the mic over to Bill Staples, Dr. Bill Staples, and have him tell us a little bit about what he's doing, and then we'll just pass the mic on down, and then I'll moderate the discussion.
Hi. I won't take much time. I've been studying surveillance for about 20 years now, and in the early 1990s when I started I won't go into how I got interested in it, but I started looking around, and it struck me that at that time, despite the history of COINTEL and the kind of FBI, usually kind of sting operations and other things that were going on, the way I said it is I thought Big Brother was sort of nowhere to be found. And in fact, as I looked more and more about different organizations, workplaces, schools, and homes, and others, I found increasingly what I call little data sponges, little kinds of digital ways in which information and other kinds of things were collected. And I saw this as a very two-way kind of deal. So parents were doing this to kids, and teachers were doing this to students, and probation officers were doing it to criminals, and et cetera, et cetera. I won't get into all the details of those devices. So I wrote a book, and it was called Everyday Surveillance. It came out in 2000. Well, 2001 happened, and as everyone generally talks about, everything seems to have changed after 2001. But from the perspective of people that have been studying surveillance for a number of years, it wasn't that everything changed. It just took on very different dimensions, and that there was lots of surveillance going on. It just wasn't this kind of Big Brother state kind of surveillance that we were seeing. But so what I use the term tiny brothers to describe these little data sponges that I was seeing. And again, they were, you know, government agencies were involved in this, but it wasn't this big orchestrated spying kind of thing. It was much more piecemeal, much more fragmented and spread out. And most of that has become part of the vernacular in terms of people describing their lives these days in terms of the kind of tiny brothers that are out there. But post 9/11 comes along, and all of a sudden, as I put it, tiny brother meets big brother. And what's happened, I find pretty incredibly interesting and disturbing, and Dave and Gary hit on this a little bit, is the fact that the NSA and the whole surveillance state organizations that are involved in surveillance didn't have to go build some very dubious spy network. It was all in place. It's called the internet. It's called telecommunications. It's called all these different ways in which the tiny brothers have been collecting information about us for a very long time now. And the mention here has been of corporations, and I think the role of the private sector in this is unbelievable. In terms of sometimes they're forced, as Gary said, to hand over information, but often they're paid for the information. And so they've been collecting all this information about us. And I would suggest that they are virtual partners in this whole thing because they benefit from it. Just this morning, the Times, which has been doing incredible coverage on surveillance issues, there were four articles in the New York Times this morning on surveillance. And one of them was how Google is using our cell phones to track where we are. And, as I said to David in an email the other day, Google's corporate philosophy was don't be evil. But I think it's turning out to be quite a different story. So the corporate partners are perfecting the various technologies and techniques in order to do all this data collection that they have an interest in selling so that they can pitch it to other corporations which are going to sell it advertising space and all that. So you walk down the street or walk into a store and your phone immediately starts giving you discounts at the stores that are right around you. Okay? Well, all that technology, again, means that the NSA and others can say, okay, well, that's great. we want that. But not to pitch you ads, but to find out where you are. I would just underscore the role of corporate America in all of this and how we can keep talking about the state. But Edward Snowden worked for Booz Allen Hamilton. He did contract work for the NSA. He worked for a major defense contractor. And they are making oodles of money off creating essentially the surveillance state.
I have several concerns about this NSA surveillance. For several generations, there's been a very delicate and troubled relationship between national security and civil liberties. And I believe, looking back and having lived as long as I have, I don't really have to read books about this because I lived it. I remember when J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI targeted communism. That was their way of opening the door to begin the surveillance. And actually what they were doing is they were spying on any political or peace organization or civil rights organization. And they targeted certain people. Dr. King, I believe at one time they said he was the most dangerous to the security of this nation. Hoover identified communism as being the target. Now we come along all these years later, and we hear them talk about terrorism and the USA Patriot Act. Now, Gary talked a lot about what COINTELPRO was really all about. When Senator Frank Church and that committee did their investigation, they found out all sorts of things that the FBI, the U.S. government was doing that was, in fact, illegal. So they put certain things in place, and one of them was that in the future, that surveillance would have to include facts that would show that some type of criminal activity was occurring. Well, there have been and it would have to be reported to the U.S. Attorney General. Well, since that time, of course, the Attorney Generals have made a lot of changes, and then when it got to Ashcroft, of course, 9/11 and all that happened. So what they have done is they've pretty much gone back to the COINTELPRO days. And so that's what I believe people, I don't know if the citizens of this country are paying attention, I don't know. Or if they don't know what's going on, they don't know the questions to ask, I'm not really sure. But this is exactly the same thing that was happening when J. Edgar Hoover and that bunch, and they admitted that they did all kinds of illegal things. You know, they went into people's offices and they stole their private information. Well, in listening to Gary and them talk about this, that's exactly what's happening to us now. But on with all of these phone cameras and they, it's the same room, they just rearranged the furniture. So my concern is that, and we're working right now with some folk, there are several of us working on something called educating the public on connecting the dots. And we're planning to start going forth in the communities, you know, working with small groups or large groups, we don't care who. But we want to provide education to the folks because we believe that the same thing that happened when Hoover started all this, we see it happening all over again. And they are, in fact, tracking people's emails and telephones, and AT&T is working with them on some things, but and they are absolutely right, because even post World War II, we if you ever get a chance to read Trading with the Enemies, you find we were in bed with all kinds of people. I mean, we have always done underhanded, you know, I don't know what they call it, clandestine or whatever, but we've always, the United States has always been involved in backdoor its citizens. And so I just appreciate this opportunity to speak about this, because I think I'm not a person, I don't know a lot about all of this stuff. It's very complicated to me, it's very confusing to me, but I know that there's something going on that's going to affect me because it's taking away my constitutional rights. And so that's why I was glad to come here today and speak to this group about that. And I hope that you all will certainly be thinking about how to get others involved, because this is a very serious, serious issue. And I think we need to really get on top of it. And I appreciate you all for allowing me this opportunity to speak. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Henry Stover. And I have known for a long time that I was focused on, because as a naturalized citizen, as a conscientious objector to war, as someone who withheld money and did not pay the full sum of money to the IRS, as a regular protester, as someone who assisted those that went out to a nuclear missile silo. I mean, this was assisted afterwards in court in 1984, when first four persons went out to a nuclear missile silo with jackhammers and compressors, and a series of plowshare actions. And we've had over 80 people arrested here in Kansas City in opposition to the Kansas City plant. And that has caused us four times to go out and obtain more than 5,000 signatures to place this on the ballot. And yes, when we would go out and arrest, I would call a police officer, the chief of police, and we'll let them know we are going to do this, we're nonviolent, and whatever. We have to be the force for truth and justice. Too many times people would like to just go to the side, hide under the park bench. I ran into a Russian couple yesterday, and I complimented them on being young lovers. And I said, did you read the Kansas City paper today? And he says, no, that's just full of lies. Well, of course, the Russians would know that Pravda, which means truth, was full of lies and whatever. But they did not want to be involved in any way. And so I think we need to start speaking truth to power. And instead of saying about the United States of America, we should say the United Stasi of America. And for those that you that don't know Stasi, that was the secret police of the East German regime. And they had neighbors and family members spying on each other. And I think we have to end up asking, what were the framers of our Constitution, this little red book? They, as was stated earlier, they were concerned not only with eavesdrops and these secret agents and whatever, but they wanted all people to be free, the right to speak out, the right to assemble, the right to associate, not be forced to quarter soldiers, not be subject to unreasonable searches and seizures. And so one thing I say is every candidate that is running for office, I don't care whether a city councilman at the federal level, I think we should demand a written statement from them that they will sign a pledge that they will work to reverse some of the secret courts that actions that have happened. You would think that we were in the Soviet Union that had show trials and secret courts. But this FISA court does not publish its opinions. And we have to confront people who have family members who work for the NSA and whatever. And they truly, honestly believe we are preventing war. But there is a war against the free people of this country. And why are we such a unique country? It's because we want to export the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. And not just blue jeans and rock and roll, but what Abraham Lincoln stood for, and the abolitionist movement, and the labor movement, and the women's movement, and whatever. And we have to build bridges. We have to connect people. We have to continually talk about this. Is this a world where people live in fear of talking about serious issues? Because this weighs on our heart, our soul, our mind. What are we going to tell our children in the future that we sat by and allowed more and more this encroachment so that we all kind of are like vanilla in opinion and we dare not speak out? The greatest gifts of our country is this creative spirit. These people that are offbeat and, you know, they go off and they invent things or they write things like William Burroughs, the Beat Generation, or explore the boundaries and whatever. We have to live and act as a free people. We cannot cower to this.
Well, very good. And I know I had an opportunity to go with Jane and the group down to Whiteman Air Base and protest the drones. And I'm sure noticing the amount of videotaping that was going on by the military, that there's probably a pretty big database of your stuff, Henry. Well,
Dave, I would like to say one other thing. We are free people, and this type of surveillance makes us all suspects. We are never to be suspects unless there is probable cause to believe that we have committed a crime. And speaking out on many different issues with all kinds of opinions from the extreme right to the extreme left, That is what free people are about. We are not suspects, and we are made that way through this huge tracking system.
Well, I think we've had some excellent opening statements by our panel, and we have a small group here. If you'd like to move further down, that would be fine, but your questions to the panel are most welcome. I guess and we'll get to those in a minute, is what Henry just said. I think what you're saying, Henry, is the Fourth Amendment says exactly that we should be secure in our houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, except if there's a probable cause and a warrant is issued. But that doesn't seem to be meaningful anymore. Is that what you're saying, Henry?
It is. This is a game that is going on. And, you know, we've got first class military, first class industrial power, and they think that we can, you know, just go and have the 800 to 1,000 military bases around the world. And it's not enough that we have satellites, but we have drones, and we buy people off and whatever. And we often partner with some very corrupt people, whether it's the dictators in Haiti or in other countries. And in some ways, we have to join the discussion. We have to be well-read. We have to come out. Because, yes, the Fourth Amendment is one of these precious rights that we have. If we don't use it, we lose it.
This is the All Souls Forum. Thank you for listening.
Funding for KKFI provided by the weekly forum at All Souls UU Church. Each Sunday at 10 a.m., the forum will feature a discussion on community issues. All Souls UU Church is at 4501 Walnut Street, one block east of Main, in Kansas City. More information is at allsoulskc.org.
Hi, this is Bobby Watson, and you're listening to 90.